Members, we're having, there's a couple issues. One, we don't have a quorum. Two, I think almost all of our testifiers are stuck in the road somewhere through the bill. And so we're going to do a little bit of switching around here. I think first we're going to have Sarah Caruso come down, who the governor appointed as the new chair of the Governor's Advisory Council on Early Childhood. She's up there talking, so she... We'd like to come down, and so we could hear a little bit about the advisory council, and hopefully until we get a quorum and we can get the bills moved, and we'll have short testimony. We do plan to adjourn early. We were going to adjourn at 5:30 anyhow, but we've had almost, I think, all of the parents have canceled because of the weather, so that is unfortunate. So we'll have a quorum now. Okay. We have a quorum now, so we'll officially call the meeting to order. I'd still like to have Sarah Caruso come forward, and we'll pass the minutes first. So moved. Representative Rosenthal moves approval of the minutes for February 21st. Is there any discussion? Oh, February 24th. Any discussion?
Sorry, I don't know if this is merits mentioned, but it looks like maybe there's a minor typo that we should be were in the first line of the minutes.
The first line, can you...
I'm sorry, that's the first line. Mrs. Mueller and Mrs. Weber were asked a series of questions. Sorry.
Okay. As well as the staff to Matthew, could you repeat the correction just so we know we got it right?
Down under testimony by Lisa Miller and Michelle Weber, when it's asking about the series of questions, there is a typo. It should be were asked a series of questions. Well, currently it says we.
Okay, thank you. We'll get that corrected. Is there anything else? Sharp eyes, Representative Downey. Is there any other discussion? Okay, hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion prevails, and the minutes for February 24th are adopted. So, Ms. Caruso, I thought we'd start out with talking about the advisory council a little bit, and then we will move into the bill from there. But if you would, hopefully, spur of the moment is okay with you.
Yeah.
And if you'd like to introduce yourself for the record and tell us a little bit about the governor's advisory council.
Sure. Good evening, Madam Chair and representatives. I am Sarah Caruso, and I am president of the Minnesota Children's Museum. Representative Farwick has asked me to speak for a few minutes on a council that I believe you all are quite aware of. It is the Governor's Council on Early Care and Education, which was the result of both federal and state legislation that was passed last session and put into motion by executive order by Governor Pawlenty. We were named to the council December of this past year, December of 2008, and we are a 17-member council. I have been named chair. We have four terrific elected officials, including Representative Slawick and Representative Demmer, and we have two senators on the council as well, Senator Terrell Clark and Senator Jeff Michelle. I would just like to comment that the additional members from on the council are really wonderful. I've met with them individually, as well as we had our first council meeting in February. And they are a diverse group in terms of representing many parts of the field, many geographies in the state, and very much unified by true hands-on experience in the field of early care and education. We have two terrific representatives from the University of Minnesota, so I think we have a nice group of people to work on this issue. We are tasked with 12 mandates that cover a variety, really cover the gamut of early childhood topics, with the ultimate goal of helping all Minnesota children be ready, completely ready for kindergarten by the year 2020. There is no doubt that we cannot do this without substantive support and partnership with the legislature here, as well as strong partnership with the Department of Ed and the Department of Human Services. I would like to say we have very strong staff support from both those departments, and they're working with great collegiality on these issues. And we also have Assistant Commissioner Karen Cleansing, and Assistant from NDE, as well as Assistant Commissioner Chuck Johnson from DHS. So again, very strong representation and partnership from the department. We, as I mentioned, had our first meeting in February, which, as you can imagine, covered a wide range of administrative and startup topics, as well as confirmed some work of a working group that was very helpful this summer, kind of helping us shape our work. I think I'll close just with the specific comment of we are going to be doing much of this work through committee over and we do have this 4-year process, and we will be staffing these committees with a combination of council members and additional community members. And I am very interested in hearing from any of your constituents or from any of you if you would like to be part of these committees. And let me just tell you what these committees are. The first is on accountability. The second is on expanding access for early care and education. The third is a quality committee looking at learning standards. And the fourth is a quality committee, if you will, focused on professional development. So those are just very small snippets of these committees, and I'm happy to share much more information on those committees and how they fit with the statute should you be interested.
Well, thank you, Ms. Crusoe. I think that's very helpful and a good overview. Are you going to be sending something out? I think it would be great if the legislators knew what committees there were and sort of if those are any time frames just yet for when they're going to be meeting. But are you going to have something more specific, sort of a job description for each one?
I'd be happy to share that with the committee, because we do have not so much job descriptions, but descriptions of the work we hope each committee will achieve. And we haven't figured out, just as you surmised, exactly the timing of how we're going to parse things out. But my goal is actually to staff all 4 committees in the February, March, and April timeframe so they can begin to work together. And we are also hoping through some, particularly through the U of M and some other resources, to bring a fair amount of background information to each committee. We certainly are not starting from scratch on any of these topics. And that's another point to emphasize. We really want to link in both with the work of the caucus, especially, and the other leading groups in this area in the state.
Thank you. And also, if we could get that on email, then each legislator could then email it out to their constituents or the folks at your schools that do early childhood. And yeah, that would be great.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we appreciate you bringing us up to speed. Members, here's the deal with the weather. We are having trouble with our testifiers on the bill. All the parents have canceled with the kids, and we are kind of waiting for our first testifier. I suppose what we should do, since we have a quorum, is we should go ahead and get started. You're also testifying on the bill, but why don't we wait just a minute for that, and then as people come in, we'll have them testify. Obviously, we can take questions. We have an amendment. We'll just do as much business as we can, and we will most likely adjourn early, especially with the pace of, and sure you're all anxious to get home too as well, or to hearings. I think the public hearings are on for tonight, so everybody that's going to those will want to give you some extra time. So Representative Rosenthal, if you want to come take the gavel.
Madam Chair, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Representative Rosenthal, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 601 for possible inclusion in the early childhood finance and policy omnibus bill, that it be laid over for possible inclusion in the early childhood finance and policy omnibus bill.
Thank you. Representative Thug has an author's amendment labeled 601A1-2. May I have a motion to put this bill in the form the author wants?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the 601A1-2 amendment. Mr. Chair, I think it would be good to get the bill in the shape, and then I can explain the bill and the amendment at the same time.
Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor that the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. Thank you all for being here. Members, this is a bill where we put together a couple of ideas so that we could talk about them together, and there's some common themes in them, and that they were all started during the last biennium, and I think all of them had one-time funding at that. So we are looking at ways to potentially continue these programs, either through the general fund or through the stimulus funding. Section one of the bill is about school readiness connections. We have worked with the department on this. There's parts we've worked with them. They don't necessarily, there's parts they like, parts they may not support as much, but I think there's the part that we want to have is to have it aligned with Parent Aware. Right now there's 14 providers involved, and it received $1 million for the current biennium. The governor does continue this project, but he does it through the underspending in the basic sliding fee program. So we know that we're not sure what's going to happen with those funds. In section two, with allowances, most of you know this was a program that was put in the bill at the last minute last time. We were able to go see the program in action when we visited the New Horizons Academy. You also have had testimony. I saw Lisa Caribou is out here, and from some of the places that have been working with the allowances. We had testifiers today that we're going to be talking to you about that are not now we're stuck in traffic or could not even get here. There is a letter of support in your packet. So what allowances do and what we're trying to do with members is give families a choice, family support where they could decide where they could put $4,000 grant for their children, whether it was for Head Start, child care, and how they were going to use that to extend and help get care for their kids. It allows families who don't qualify for Head Start and MSEP to receive assistance for child care too, and that's something that testifiers were going to talk about. The last one, which is the reason with Caruso Care, is it President Caruso or CEO Caruso?
Anything other than hey you is fine.
President Caruso. I participated in a family, friend, and neighbor grant that was $750,000 for the current biennium. Again, as you will see in the way the bill is written, we have open allocations blank on that. And it provided 6 grants to groups partnering to provide resources to family, friend, and neighbor providers. So, Mr. Chair, what I think I'd like to do is have Ms. Caruso testify, and then we'll see if we get any of our other testifiers in here. Oh, we have another one. That is here. So if you want to come down, we're on the bill now. And so if you want to come down, so I'll have Ms. Caruso start, and then we'll have our second testifier.
President Caruso, please.
Mr. Chair. Do I need to reintroduce myself?
Yes,
for the record. My name is Sarah Caruso, and I'm president of Minnesota Children's Museum. And I'm here to talk about our participation in one of the FSN programs that was funded as Representative Flawless outlined. We are not the lead agency on the grant. Neighborhood House is the lead agency, and they were not able to be here today. So what I would like to do is just briefly outline what our grant covers, and then talk a little bit more specifically about the role Minnesota Children's Museum played. The target population for this proposal is the informal care network in St. Paul in 3 difficult neighborhoods, the West 7th Sydney neighborhood, the West Side, and the Midway areas of St. Paul. And all of these areas have low-income housing complexes and schools that have large concentrations of children, low-income children and immigrant children, including Somalis, Ethiopians, Eritreans, Latinos, and Hmong. And this, I think one of the real strengths of this particular partnership are the five groups that have come to work together, and I think these names will all be familiar to you. As I mentioned, Neighborhood House is the lead organizing agency. Minnesota Children's Museum is providing the parent-child classes and educational kits for in-home use to the FFM providers. Common Bond Communities is another agency, and they are the management at Skyline Towers, which is one of our primary locations that we're working in. Prevent Child Abuse Minnesota is another agency working with parents on self-esteem and services to prevent child abuse. And then Resources for Child Caring is the fifth agency, and they are a strong partner in providing assistance with outreach to providers and marketing and really helping deliver our audience to our programs. Specifically, Minnesota Children's Museum's role has been, and we've worked for the first year in Skyline Towers, and in the second year we're working through Homecroft Elementary School, is to provide parent-child classes, which we have the ability to give in Spanish, Hmong, or English. And these classes are to build skills for the FFM providers as they're working with children. And these classes cover a wide range of topics, working from self-esteem and sort of the adult perspective and how you interact with children. They also cover things like nutrition, creative play, reading books. So they're kind of a combination of classes that help build skills for the adults who are leading these FFN groups, as well as provide content-rich activities to help the children learn. And again, we've been pleased with our ability to deliver these programs in a variety of languages. We also are very careful to customize not only our language but the activities to be culturally appropriate in each setting. The one kind of global comment I would like to make, and I believe I have said this last year when we were reporting on this program, it's very clear to us that there is not one FFN provider in Minnesota that knows they're an FFN provider. I mean, that might be a small exaggeration, but I don't think so. These wonderful people are providing care for, you know, as the title says, for their neighbors, for their grandchildren, for their second cousins. And if you said to them even, are you providing daycare, they would say, no, I am helping out my family or I'm helping out my neighbors. And I think that is perhaps a subtle but really important piece of understanding as we provide services and make policy of how sort of delicate and fragile this network is. It's wonderful to have named it, and I think Friends, Family, Neighbors is a very accurate description of who these people are. But we must always remember it's not an entity such as the House of Representatives here in the state that we can go to and kind of work with in a efficient, systematic way. These are simply adults who are doing the best they can for the children in their lives. And that creates a very delicate and complicated dynamic sometimes, and one that frankly is quite expensive from a service delivery standpoint, because you have to work with them really as individuals, and you have to reach out to them in a whole variety of ways. And I think these are things that you're aware of, but they're certainly things that we are experiencing both through this grant, and I know the other agencies who are working with us are also experiencing that.
Thank you, and I think to speak well of what we were trying to do last year is we had the opportunity to get some one-time funds, as Representative Greiling will remember, and this is one of those areas we were able to spend those in. And FFN is kind of the somewhat hidden but very prevalent world of how people are taking care of their kids and how they're helping neighbors and grandmas and everybody. So I think that it's important for the legislature to start to look at that and how we can have a role in that. So thank you. Next, I'd like to welcome Rico Alexander, who's the Health Care Director for HICA, and she is going to talk about the allowances.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rico Alexander. I'm the Head Start Director for Parents Community Action, a private nonprofit organization. We provide Head Start services to over 2,200 children and families in North Minneapolis. I'm here today to speak to you about the pre-K allowance program and to let you know how it has strengthened our Head Start program and early Head Start program. and to recommend the ways in which we believe that the program can be more beneficial to our community. The pre-K allowance program has provided our agency with a valuable additional source of revenue when parents who have children enrolled in our program who choose to apply for the allowance. The pre-K allowance we have received have helped our program finance important quality improvements without redirecting existing funding, reducing our enrollment, or sacrificing other programs and services. We have used our pre-K allowances to finance program improvements such as providing our additional training for our teachers in early Head Start and Head Start and other staff members, providing financial assistance to teachers who have to complete with a federally funded mandate required by Head Start performance standards, and purchasing additional materials and supplies which help enhance our classrooms and with a child-friendly, multicultural learning environment. In short, the pre-K allowances have helped us better train our staff, makes it easier for our staff to assist our parents and others in with the federally funded requirements, as I had mentioned earlier, without the undue negative impact of our agency and program budget. The program is not without its challenges, though, and this is the very important piece to it all. Given that the population that we serve is a low-income, highly mobile population, most parents are concerned with the day-to-day stresses, seeking employment, obtaining affordable housing, and meeting the most basic needs of their families. Even when informed about the pre-K allowances, parents may not fully understand it and are reluctant to devote the time and effort into filling out the applications and the other needed documentation. Still, other parents face the language or culture barriers to understanding the process and completing the necessary paperwork. Our staff have invested substantial time and effort into informing the eligible parents about the program and assisting them in completing the necessary paperwork should they choose to apply. Still, the participation rate is not as high as we would like to see it. If more parents were to participate in the pre-K allowance programs such as PICA and other Head Start programs, would be able to continue making program improvements and providing a higher quality of services to the families who are the most needy in our community. We feel that parents could benefit more fully from the program if the application procedures were simplified. And for this reason, I would recommend that the program modify the application process to accept some of the enrollment documentation that we ask for when we enroll our families. At PICA, we have a comprehensive and detailed enrollment procedure that requires parents to provide verification of income and other documents that are also required on the pre-K application. If parents who are already overwhelmed by the stresses placed on the families by poverty, unemployment, and you know, looking for housing and those sorts of things, completing yet another application is the last thing that they want to do. We would recommend that PICA's application be accepted as sufficient proof to qualify families for pre-K allowance. This would also work for other child care programs if their application forms had complete sufficient information. Accepting the child care agency's own application would not only reduce the stress of the families that they are served, but also the child care staff members as well, who have to allocate their time and effort into other numerous efforts to work on behalf of the families. In closing, I want to stress once again that the pre-K allowance pilot has the ability and the opportunity to be a great benefit to Head Start programs, as well as other child care programs, who strive to provide the programs and services needed to children and families in crisis. I urge you to strongly consider procedures that are easier for parents who wish to apply, making the program more user-friendly for parents and providers would encourage greater use of the program and would result in even more children and families benefiting from the program. Thanks for your attention.
Mr. Chair, a couple things. I want to thank you for how long did it take you?
It was an hour and a half.
Hour and a half.
Thank you for coming. We've never seen snow before.
I know we very much appreciate you.
I know there's a few questions from members. Would you like us to wait, or would you like to...
I think we should go, Mr. Chair, I think we should go ahead with the allowances part and then come back to the libraries. We're in the FFN part, so maybe we could take questions on that. At the library presentation and do allowance questions now. Does that make sense?
Okay. Representative Greiner.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Alexander, you mentioned the application process, and we have certainly heard that before.
Okay.
And St. Paul Public Schools, it sounds like it's a nightmare, and former Superintendent Karstarfen has talked about it several times. And I'm wondering, Representative Slawick, why we have this very complicated application process that gets in the way of families that are already struggling. I just think we always put up so much paperwork for anybody trying to qualify for anything, especially struggling families. And why is this so complicated?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reiling, I think you make a good point. A couple things. It's interesting hearing former coming to serve on it. If you didn't know, she took the job in Austin, so that was very interesting right there. But I think the application, the department doesn't happen to have a copy of the application, do they, with them? We have passed one around the committee, I think, before, have we? If we could get another one. One, I'd like the members to see it. It is incredibly complicated. When this legislation passed, if you remember, it was kind of put in the conference committee bill. I think you remember as well, Representative Reiling, in the middle of the night, and came out without the details of the program had not been well thought out, to say the least. And so it was given to the Department of Human Services, and then they had to come out with the whole program, which was a lot to do. And they tell us, I mean, maybe you all came up with the application, I didn't, that this is what they needed. There is, you know, everything from immigration information on there to all kinds of things. I mean, you could probably tell us a lot more about it. And one thought is, I mean, I know that Senator Clark, just so you know, is interested in just doing a simple, that the application should be based just strictly on income. Okay. And if we could get the Department of Revenue to give us income, like they do for schools, who qualifies for reduced and free lunch, then you maybe wouldn't even have to have an application. You could just, those would be the families that would be eligible, period. And you wouldn't go through the process.
Well, I mean, just so you understand, I'm sure you know this, that the Head Start, we provide services for children who are at 100% of poverty, you know, as opposed to 185% of poverty. So if we did that, you know, naturally, you know, pretty much all of our children would be eligible. But what we do in terms of verifying income, we when a parent comes in to enroll their child, we look at the information, whether it's a check stub, whether it's whether they're on MFIP, and we verify it. We don't ask for copies or anything like that. We sign a verification form for someone who witnessed the documentation, hold that on file, you know. And we don't ask for some of that information that is required from the pre-K allowances. We just I just ask that if we do this, you know, it just makes it a little easier. So if we have a family enrolled in our program, and they're eligible for the allowance, we have to then go back and say, you know, do you mind giving us copies of your checks if they're working parents? Copies of your check stubs over the last month when they have already verified the income with us and we have it on file. If we can just, if that can be sufficient, you know, to move forward to use as an eligible piece of document for the process will be much easier for us to work with, you know. Because it takes a while for parents to go back. You know, we're playing phone tag and, you know, going back and forth with parents when they're trying to deal with some of the other stresses in their life. So.
Representative Grimes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more question for Mr. Alexander. With the allowances, how many more children are you serving?
Actually, there's a number of different ways you can use the allowances, which is a beautiful thing about it. I may ask, you know, given the lean times for Head Start programs, we use the money to improve our quality, you know, as I had mentioned. And so we were able to use the money to send teachers to school, provide training for staff, provide equipment in the classroom, those sorts of things, you know, and which are all eligible uses up under the program.
So you need to answer the question.
Oh, well, I'm sorry.
How many?
No additional children we provided. You know, understand that $4,000, the cost for a Head Start child is much more than $4,000, you know, so zero.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative
Slavik, that's one of my problems with the allowances.
Representative
Fowler. Well, that was the point. I probably should screen the testifiers a little more. But, you know,
I mean,
we're working on it. Let me just answer. And I see Alice Dillon, if you want to raise your hand, the head of PICA is up there. There are other uses. And that's the debate about allowances is if we had hoped, I think, that the goal was that it was to serve additional kids, and so here's a case where it's not doing that. Probably good to that we know that now, you know, that there are different uses of it. And as you know, we'll be having discussions about whether to continue for them. Do you want to say anything?
Well, yeah, I mean, it may work for our program, the Head Start program, and what, you know, the cost of a child is slightly higher than $4,000. And even the $4,000 is not a guarantee, you know, given that a parent can move from one program to the next, you know. It's just not feasible for us to do it. Now, I wouldn't, maybe a child care program, home daycare, or, you know, another child care program may benefit from something like that, but for our program, it just, we use it for the other available uses. So.
Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, mine was just a follow-up also with the forms. And I had the question as to whether the requirements dealt with maybe the federal requirements, but, you know, when you go to the Department of Education, the forms are pretty simple, and they're based on free and reduced lunch, and that's what they need to have. And so I was trying to determine why the elaborate process, and it seems like you're investigating that and going to change it. So I'm not sure if anybody knows other than it was set up that way, and it looks, sounds like you're going to change it. So,
Mr. Chair, I guess I would let this Ms. Deb. You look, I'm blanking out on her name. Close in class. If you come down, if you see. I would just like her to talk about that, just because there was a big debate about if you had it in MDE, especially the immigration piece and so forth, I believe, and I would just like you to articulate why it's in DHS. And what, when it's in DHS, well, why what that kind of application requires as opposed to an MDE, or maybe just why you decided.
Welcome, and could you identify yourself for the record?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Deb Swenson-Clad. I'm with the Department of Human Services, Child Development Services Unit. I don't think I can answer the question about why the allowance program ended up this. The Department of Human Services versus the Department of Education, the legislation did come to us. And I think that we approached the development of the application by looking at the requirements in the law and outlining an application, a set of application questions that would allow us to use to determine eligibility with those based on those criteria. We looked at other applications that are used in the Department of Human Services. The application itself that captures the criteria for eligibility is 2 pages in length. There are additional materials that the department uses both to ensure that parents know about their rights and responsibilities, the data privacy provisions. So it does make for a lengthier document, but I think that there are certainly ways that we can look at simplifying the application while still capturing the criteria that the information that's needed to ensure that we're determining eligibility correctly. And we certainly talked with and are continuing to be in conversation with. Our partners at MDE and the grantees that oversee the allowances and the different programs that are represented to look towards simplification as we are able.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one follow-up question. Then if we're going to have funding from, let's say there's an overlap of funding between the Department of Health Human Services or Human Services and the Department of Ed, will those forms have to be exactly alike? I assume they're different now, and, you know, both are getting allowances of some sort, I would assume. So are those forms going to have to be exactly the same, or would they be able to be different?
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, I'm not sure I understand the question. Are you referring to the free and reduced lunch form that
right.
the Department of Education
right.
uses? Or that school districts use across the state. I think that that form, which does ask many of the same questions that are asked on the allowance form is one that we can look at and conceivably use for considering eligibility for the allowance program. We would just need to do some more investigation and work with Department of Education on that process.
But, and just one last question, but they would need to be the same if we're doing overlapping funds, is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, I'm not sure what you mean by overlapping funds.
Well, coordinated funds. I mean, we're talking with the allowances that they might fit, you know, from there might be layering of funds, and so would the form have to be, if you're going to do layering of funds to fund a particular child in a particular program, would there be one form that would have to be used that would be for both? Mm-hmm. They'd have to be the same. Mm-hmm.
Maybe you have to start in the morning and child care in the afternoon. So
right.
Start is governed by
NIH.
Or would you have to have two different forms?
Yeah. Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, we do have an example in St. Paul in that allowance grantee area of using the same form for the scholarship program as the allowance program, because in that case we are layering funding and also ensuring that the funding for families receiving child care assistance is layered with those other two sources of funding. So in that case, we're gaining some experience, I think, in how to use single forms or several forms to make the process of application easier.
Thank you. Representative Fitzgibbon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I heard that we do have more testifiers to come forth, and so, Mr. Chair, if it would please you, I'll withhold my question and maintain my place in line until all public testimony is concluded.
Appreciate it. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll defer to the chair or the testifiers if it would make sense, but actually my question might in part be for Ms. Lunson-Klatt. As I'm learning these things, this is kind of new news to me, so I'm a little shocked that that allowances don't simply add new kids into the program. So I will just make that as a comment. And then this question about the enrollments and the eligibility determination, it sounds like the sentiment here is that we've erred on the side of over-verification. If we could simplify it, that would be a good thing. I think we're all in favor of streamlining, but I'm curious, how do we audit those eligibility determinations today, and what would that have to look like if we actually made it less onerous?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the department has approached the allowances project as a pilot initiative with the one-time funding that's in place currently. Funding flows to grantees, the City of St. Paul, Hennepin County, and Blue Earth and Nicollet counties. And those grantees are responsible for the administration of the funds to local early childhood programs. So I think there are several ways in which oversight is being carried out of the funding. One of the most important is actually occurring through the evaluation of the pilot project. The evaluator is an entity called SRI International, and the funding for the evaluation comes through the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, which is named in legislation as having a responsibility for the evaluation. So much of what I think we'll be learning about how the allowance program is administered will come to us from the evaluation and the processes that the data gathering that SRI is doing with the grantees and the individual early childhood programs to understand how the funds are being used during this pilot period. That evaluation is due to us this coming September, and there are detailed records being collected from participating early childhood programs on how funding is being used for each child in the programs. At the same time, early childhood programs will be asked at the end of the pilot project to submit a final report that shows us, again, how they've spent their allowances dollars, for which of the eligible uses they've spent those dollars. And in the meantime, as grantees are administering these dollars to early childhood programs, there's the process takes place through a reimbursement process with programs submitting invoices indicating how they plan to use those dollars, and then dollars are released from the grantees to those programs.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick follow-up then. I know, and I'm maybe jumping ahead, but in the bill it talks about leveraging the federal stimulus, the kind of state bailout portion of the stimulus package, to augment some of these funding streams. And so I guess maybe the question is, would those funds go through the exact same kind of pilot process, funding stream mechanism, and audit or lack thereof audit of the eligibility determination?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think if we were able to use economic stimulus funds for this program, we would be entering into a next phase of the pilot of this, and looking at our audit procedures in light of what the evaluation tells us and the lessons learned from the pilot. So I think we'd certainly be looking for stringent audit procedures, but gaining and building off of the information we've learned from this first pilot phase.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms.
Mr. Chair, I have a couple more with Nancy Johnson, Ms. Fidel, and we have a family friend of neighbor, so we have those. Do we have a third? If we could have these two, and then two on the stage nearby. Representative Valley, I will tell you, I the option of those funds in today just have kind of a placeholder. You know, as we know, we all don't know exactly how the stimulus funds are going to be able to be used, so it's kind of they're not knowing for sure if we could tap into them or not. But Mr. Chair, like Nancy Johnson, I'll go next.
Thank you. Welcome. Your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And I apologize, I did leave Wayzata today at 2:30.
Wow.
So it's been a long drive. And I also am very disappointed that we had two families who really wanted to share their story about why they needed a pre-K allowance and what it's done and some things about their children. And both of them have other children, and for them to drive all the way from Plymouth and Wayzata here, and we weren't even sure if the hearing was going to continue because at that point it was a total whiteout. So sorry that they won't be here to testify, but if we can, you know, maybe get their information to you in writing, I think they would like to do that. And I just wanted to say very briefly that the pre-K allowance is really working in our pilot. We're a pilot that covers the Wayzata Public School District, so that's primarily about two-thirds of Plymouth and the city of Wayzata. And the pilot that I'm speaking of is the Caring for Kids Initiative, which is a partnership between a local social service organization, Interfaith Outreach and Community Partners, and the Wayzata Public Schools. And initially one child quality child care program, Kids Care Connection, and now we have 10 different programs that are part of this. We're a community scholarship fund where we blend the funds that are available, whether it's public funds going to school readiness or through CCAP funds to child care. We encourage parents to apply for their child care tax credits. And then we also raise private money so that we can assure families who come to us that they can get a full year of a scholarship in a high-quality program. And we served an additional 40-some children this year with pre-K allowance. There are actually 50 allowances that were part of, because we're a small area compared to Minneapolis and St. Paul, so we got much fewer given to us. But we had all of them placed within about 4 months, all 50 of the pre-K allowances. Those are all new children. And I can't say for sure that none of those children would have gotten services without the pre-K allowance, but I do know that the children associated with the Caring for Kids project would not have gotten services because we already have a waiting list. And it helped families and children in two different ways. One way is that the $4,000 is enough for a part-time program that offers 12 hours a week for 9 months a year. That $4,000 can pay for the whole program. The other benefit is that it accesses or leverages transportation through the district. So for those families who are working during the day, but they can still make it work because someone is at home during the day, but they don't have transportation, it takes a lot of work. And that's one of the challenges with this program. But we were able to do that. And it's a little more difficult for child care programs. Partly because, of course, $4,000 is less than a quarter of the cost of child care for some children. So when you're looking at trying to package this, what we were able to do is for some of the children who were already getting CCAP, then we were able to put this money sort of surrounding that money so that they had no copay. And for many of these families, families making, at the poverty level or a little above, the copayment that they're required to pay is sometimes the one thing that will keep them out of making that choice to go to a quality program. Then for some of the other families, we've had situations where they're able to get 3 months of their child care paid, and then they get on to the child care CCAP list. So they're on the waiting list for 3 months. They use the pre-K allowance as a bridge fund, and then they're receiving CCAP. So there's many ways that we're making it work. The things that our providers and families said to be sure and say is they like the fact that there is a choice element. They like the fact that there's a cooperative element. If it's run with some of the coordination that we are providing through our Caring for Kids initiative work, and I think in the other pilots as well, it does take that kind of coordination in addition to just the letter that goes to the parents. But then they also like that it's a real focus on early ed. And right now, as you know, the way that the state funds child care, where most of the children are, where most of the low-income children are, there just really isn't a focus on early ed except through these special pilots. So, again, they said that was a really huge benefit of the pre-K allowance.
Thanks.
Sure, I think I'd like to have the last part and then open up the
phone. Sounds great. For the record,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Emily Watts. I'm a senior librarian with the Hennepin County Library, and I served as the project manager for the Friend, Family, Neighbor Childcare Grant that the Hennepin County Library, the Library Foundation of Hennepin County, received to be able to provide services to Friend, Family, Neighbor Childcare families living in Hennepin County. We were so pleased to be a recipient of one of the pilot project grants. We know that coming through the doors of our libraries are countless people who are quite clearly not the parents of the children that they're there with, but are there caring for those children and providing some kind of educational or entertainment or sort of enriching experience in those children's lives. And so we took that knowledge, the knowledge that we know that libraries are connectors of information to people. But if people think that librarians know a lot of things. I tell people I work in a library, and they say, oh, you must be so smart. And I'm like, I don't know anything. But what I do know is where to find information that can help you have a richer life, that can help you have a better and more successful experience. And that's something that the library was able to do then, was to connect 59 friend, family, neighbor, child care providers from the three target audiences that we were serving, the African, the Latino, and the Hispanic communities, to serve as what we called our community ambassadors. We know that people get their information from what they consider to be trusted sources. And those trusted sources aren't always the news reports or the research reports or the data that's being provided by organizations that they don't know very well. You get your information from your friends, and you get them from your neighbors, and you get them from the lady standing next to you and that you see every week at church. So we wanted to leverage that capacity of people getting their information from their circle of friends by inviting a core group of friend, family, neighbor, childcare providers
to meet with us monthly, where we connected them to community resources, including respected organizations such as PACER Center, Minneapolis ECFE, the American Lung Association, and others, to friend, family, neighbor providers, and let them know, here's the information that they have to share. Here's the wisdom that they want to share with you. Then those 69 people went out and talked to approximately between 7 and 10 people each. We reached about an additional 600 people through our project. Through sharing that information from that core group of community ambassadors, they took what they have learned out into the community and shared that with other people. So this has been a hugely successful project for us, and it wouldn't have been possible without the funding that we received. It's not that we didn't exist as a library or that we didn't know the PACER Center existed and the good information that PACER Center had to offer. It's that PACER Center was looking for an audience, and we were looking for a way to draw people together. And so we pulled the two groups together, and we were able to be able to share that information and make a difference in people's lives. We actually had one family who, as a result of their participation in the Community Ambassador Project, went back and they said to their neighbor, you know, I know that people tell you it's no big deal that your son doesn't talk, even though he's 4, but we're thinking it might be a problem. And that I met this really great woman from the PACER Center. She's got great information about testing and about information and resources. She's someone you can trust, and I really, really liked her. And indeed, they were able to connect this family who would have never known about the services that were available to the services at PACER Center, and their little boy is now just excelling and doing very, very well, talks apparently up a blue streak. And it's just the impact in families' lives has been absolutely incredible. We also had a secondary target goal of connecting families to traditional ECFE programs, and so we were able to use a combination of our community ambassadors and our outreach worker that we hired through our grant to be able to talk about early childhood education programs. And we were able to sponsor, we're actually sponsoring our 4th program right now to connect African grandparents in Northwest Hennepin County, predominantly in Brooklyn Center and Brooklyn Park, to the experience of early childhood education. Our preliminary results in the project that we were running in Minneapolis with our first 3 projects is that we've had 100% participation of the families who were in our pilot ECFE program continue on and enroll in a traditional ECFE program. It's a pilot project, so the numbers are not huge, but it's certainly a great start to being able to connect families to those resources that they need. We've learned a tremendous amount through our participation in the project. And the thing that we hope for, and we know that other people who have gotten funding through this same project all wish the same thing, we hope to be able to take the lessons that we've learned with continued funding and be able to improve our programs, be able to make adjustments and make continued improvements so that we can continue to connect with even more families than we already have.
Thank you. How long did it take you to get there?
Just about 2.5 hours. I keep in Minnetonka.
Thank you for coming here.
It's an extremely important project to us. We weren't going to stay home.
She better know some like a really neat diagram so I can tell you librarians do things differently.
We don't know any more than anyone else. We might just think differently.
Well, thank you. Representative Diskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me, I do have a series of questions pertaining to the bill, and Madam Chair, I'll direct them all to you, if you don't mind. Madam Chair, I'm very curious about the nature of a pilot program, and I'm talking about the program that begins on page 3, line 16. The Kindergarten Exploratory Projects. If you could, being new to this committee, Madam Chair, enlighten me as to why we established these exploratory projects. What were we trying to find out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Diskin, as you can see, we're still finding out things, so it's kind of interesting. This was a project that came to light really from the work that Art Rolnick did. Art Rolnick had this idea that if you gave families money and let them make the choices with what to do with it, then you would overall help kids and help the families. Ideally, he could do a program that was about $14,000 per kid, and it's being done through the MELP program. The state couldn't do that. So we took on a $4,000 per kid price tag for about $6 million, which is what could be sort of squeezed out of the bill, frankly, at the very last minute. So the idea was to try, if you gave families money on a flexible basis, that they could couple with Head Start or, you know, Head Start childcare, another arrangement in the afternoon, all those different types of things that families are doing, that you might see and hopefully would see flexibility as well as more high-quality care for our young children.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Madam Chair, if something is a pilot project, then when a project goes in, you have a definitive start date and an end date. That's the purpose of a project. And, folks went in here with their eyes wide open that this was a 2-year project and we were going to learn something from this, alright? I am concerned that we haven't learned what we needed to learn and that we're continuing these pilot projects, and I'm even more concerned as a mathematician and a statistician and somebody who enjoys research that we're actually changing the nature now of the project in the middle of the study of whether or not this works. We're changing the nature by changing the eligibility levels. We're changing the nature by adding, I don't understand why, but what something I think is a real poison pill here in the legislature, which is a gag rule on whether or not the people being funded are legal and or illegally in this country. So that concerns me now. I just need to fully vet this. I think I learned that from Chair Pawlowski, that it's better to fully vet stuff in committee, so if you don't mind. Another thing I'm going to share, and I don't expect a response on this issue, but Madam Chair, on Section 2 of the bill, lines 3.23 and 4.35, changing from 185% of federal poverty guidelines to now 46% of state median income, I think if I heard correctly, the rationale for that was to be able to capture some of these kids who don't qualify for Head Start or for NSFIP dollars, meaning we are now going to be giving very scarce state resources to people who could probably afford it. And we just had this conversation in K-12 finance maybe a little more than an hour ago, where the chair of that committee very rightly said maybe we've got to look at how we focus our money, and instead of using state resources for people who can't afford it, we should refocus, and this was on school lunch and free and reduced lunch, refocus on to the families who can't afford these programs. I do have a question, Madam Chair, on Section 5. As the minority lead in the Committee on Finance, we had quite a discussion one day on how we are going to be constructing the state budget. So, Madam Chair, prior to this biennium starting, I know that both the Majority Leader of the Senate and the Speaker of the House had talked about embracing zero-based budgeting, right? Had looked into it, and rightfully, I said, wow, that's pretty massive, right? And I appreciate that, right? But he did say that we are going to, within our committees, be looking at priority-based budget. And now I see on page 5, lines 10 and line 21, that it looks like we are reverting back to just old base budgeting rather than even priority-based. And can you explain, am I missing something, or is this the factor then going to be, if we do move this forward, then this is our priority? And what criteria would we have used to create that priority?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sifkins, as far as priorities and priority-based budgeting, I sent a letter to Commissioner Segrin, I sent a letter to Commissioner Ludeman asking them for their priorities, and they very kindly sent one back and said, well, the governor's priorities are our priorities, which meant, I guess, well, we really don't understand that when we're trying to work with departments. We gave them a model of the courts. The courts ranked high, medium, and low their programs. We're trying to do that in partnership, and we got basically buffaloed, said we're not going to participate. So one, it's really hard to work with departments that won't work with us in that process. So where they fall in the priorities, we don't know for the department, that's for sure, as far as where they fall. For us, I'll tell you, they are on the outside edge, because as you know, they're one-time funding, and this, when you have one-time funding, we have to find it again, and to your point, it would be only if the money is available. We added it to the base primarily because these have worked school readiness service agreements, according to Ms. Kotelnik, who has testified on those, and on statistics we have seen on those. Those have worked pretty well, and very well, and so it seemed to be some benefit to continue those. With the pre-kindergarten exploratory project, I think that the jury is still out, and as you can see, I don't know if you had even more input today on that, so I think that the Senate might be more in favor of those at this point. And the Family, Friend, and Neighbor grants, we're hearing of the good things that have happened in that. They, when we have that they are added to the base, I think that's ideally. Family, Friend, and Neighbor and all of these, because they were one time, if they seem also potentially to be good candidates for the stimulus money, as you know, which is officially called the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, because those are one-time funds. But that's kind of where we see the lay of the land. I mean, these, out of, our first job in this committee, I mean, the way I see it, I mean, this is where I have my chair hat on, is keeping current things going, and frankly, as you know, we're going to have to cut that. We're going to have to cut our base. So this is a bill we wanted to get the ideas out there, but this is potentially probably candidates for that one-time money more than almost anything else.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Madam Chair, I do appreciate that response. Just to, as far as the setting priorities and waiting for the governor's office, I'll come back and say, even I'm not wearing a "what would Governor Pawlenty do" bracelet, all right? I think it's time for us to lead, all right? And not wait for the department, but to get out front and say, this is how we're going to lead, and these are our priorities, and I look forward to that taking place. One more concern and then one more question. My concern is on the amendment, lines 110 to 113. I think 13% for administrative costs in any funds is awfully high. And I know we're allowing administrative costs from two different entities, and so that adds up. Neither are 13%, but in total, the use of these funds, we're looking at 13% being absorbed in administrative costs. I think that's awfully high. The final thing I'll ask, Madam Chair, there are a number of places in this bill. I'll pick out two, lines 1.22 and lines 3.13, where we are actually making fiduciary decisions based on quality rating standards, and quality rating standards, Madam Chair, that haven't even been reported on. The legislature did ask MELF to study and provide a report. Now, that is still in process, and in fact, the legislature deemed it appropriate so that this could thoroughly be vetted, all right, that the report wasn't even due until December of 2011, and yet we are putting these standards as criteria for expending state dollars, and I'm wondering if that's not almost bordering on irresponsible.
Can you tell me a line, Mr. Chair, Representative, where you're looking at exactly?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. I'm looking at page 1, line 22. And, Madam Chair, I'm looking at page 3, line 13.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Simmons, hopefully I can get all the answers in. First of all, as to your part about the administration expenses, my understanding, and I can ask staff this, is that the 8% was the administration, the percentage we had for the exploratory project in the original bill. Is that correct? Or how do we end the 5%?
Mr. Chair and Representative Swalick, I don't think there was any language in the statute or the law that specified how much could be used for administration, but I think for practical purposes, up to 8% is what the grantees were allowed to use.
Right. So that's I knew there was a connection. It was what the grantees were allowed to use, up to 8%. You know, the 5%, I think was along similar lines. We can work on those, Representative Biskins. I'm willing to bring those down. You know, the way these were designed, and I have to say, we were not involved in the design, and it was incredibly complicated. They went out to St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Blue Earth, and they were actually fiscal agents for each of those that controlled those. It was a very different model. Sort of reminded me of the charter school testimony we had in policy this morning. You know, we had somebody else kind of administering the funds. So it's, I think it's something we can definitely take a look at. As far as having the parent aware language in there, I think that's a good point, that if we may be putting the cart before the horse in terms of if we are having that in, but we don't necessarily adopt the parent aware system through the legislature, right, which will probably be, you know, I think through our discussions, it might be a late night decision at the very end of session about whether this moves ahead or not. We do understand that it's eligible for the stimulus money, that folly rating systems are eligible. Our goal would be partially to do that, but we also could do that. I'm thinking, Mr. Chair, that I might want to lay the bill over.
Absolutely. I move that House File 601 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Omnibus.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I was going to table the bill, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. With that, I think we'll adjourn, and thank you everybody who came from many hours and distance and got home safely. Now adjourn.